must be Mike.
Yeah.
Mike Weber?
Yeah.
It makes you feel already. You chum away.
Yes.
All right. That's serious. All right, let's get right into it. Let's start with Board of Prayer, all right? Heavenly Father, I want to thank you again for this day and thank you for the privilege of being able to work with and for you. All right, well, yesterday, of course, we focused mostly on audio. And a couple of things. Let me put it back up here. What's that?
Audio.
All right. Let's put something down here. Remember yesterday we listened to a couple of things regarding EQ. We heard the voice, you know, like how they manipulated the different sounds and stuff. Also we heard what compression, and what was compression?
It tops it off?
Yes. Compression, basically, trumpet's a good example. The sample we listened to, of course, was the bass drum. That compression is basically a way to automatically adjust the volume at a specified point or a frequency. And you also, with a compressor, can control when that happens, how fast it happens. Remember with the bass drum when they went off, when they had it too fast, you didn't hear the strumming. When they delayed it, then you heard the strum, but then it cut it. So, one of the things I know some of the engineers have worked with, some of the beginning people, they'll put way too much compression. So the general advice is be light. Just like when we were talking on the mixing board, just avoid that, keep pushing the levels up. That's a bad thing. Remember we talked about the trim, or sometimes it's called gain. This is where you just want to make sure you get solid sound. This isn't another place to raise the volume. And that's a common mistake. And then remember, we use the auxiliaries for monitoring. But we want to make sure the monitors are on
free
fade. Why is that?
So when you adjust the fader, it doesn't affect the...
Exactly. Yeah. Because if it's post-fader, what that's basically saying, it's after this fader. So when you're raising this up, you're raising the monitors on the stage as well. So you want to make sure that's pressed at pre-fader. We have the option of doing stereo, but why do you normally do mono? Well, if you remember, stereo is left and right. You're on the left side of the...
You're going to be listening one side only.
Side, right? You know, only a few people get to sit in the sweet spot. So there's a few people that have a great experience, and the rest, you know, it's like so. When it comes to feedback, what is one of the basic principles of avoiding feedback relating particularly to where your speakers are placed?
The speakers must be facing the auditory, and the person who has the microphone will be behind.
Yes. The speaker should always be in front of the farthest mic forward. Now, that's one of the challenges you have with monitors. Remember we talked about people that are using the microphones, they need to use them properly. If you have your monitors out there and they drop them down like this, you know, or they'll get lazy, so you have to raise it up because their mic isn't up here, then you're picking up more, you know, ambient, and that could create a feedback.
But if you have someone like, you know, they have their radio slave mics, and then they have mics that go out into the audience for questions and things like that.
Because you're far enough out there, it's generally not going to be a problem.
It's going to threaten you.
Well, basically what it is creating a loop, and so the farther away, and it's delayed and all that kind of stuff, you're probably okay, because you shouldn't have to boost the level so loud that if you're in the middle of the audience, that should be an issue. I know in our church where the challenge is really coming, it's a combination of monitoring, and, if you get an electric guitar or singers, and they keep wanting the monitors louder and louder and louder. So you can get it so loud on the stage that if you turn off the house speakers, you probably can hear just fine. That's a bad thing. That's feedback asking to happen somewhere. And remember, one of the things we mentioned, someone might say, hey, I can't hear myself in the monitors. You might think, okay, well, I'm going to raise them up. The solution, quite likely, could be to bring someone else down. And I say that basically the idea is keep your levels down. Don't keep pushing. Because pretty much, with all the electronic stuff, there should be plenty of power there to get, what you need. You get up, what is it, above 100? Something like that, it starts hurting, painful. So most, some people around 104, it starts becoming uncomfortable. So you should have plenty of power in most systems. All right, so we reviewed the pre-fader, stereo, or why we do mostly mono. Let me remind you one thing about phase. Remember we talked about this yesterday. There are a variety of things that can affect your sound on the stage. And one of those is what we were just talking about, the monitors. You keep raising up the levels. And so you have so much sound on the stage, plus your house sound, and it's ricocheting all over the place. You kind of think, why is things so muddy? That's one of the reasons. Yeah.
Well, why was it mostly mono?
What's that?
Why was it mostly mono?
Because stereo is basically built on the idea that you can hear left and right, mm-hmm. and in a sanctuary setting, in an auditorium setting, unless you're sitting in the center, you're not going to get that experience. So if you're on the left side and you're doing stereo, you're not going to hear all that over here. And this starts exceeding my expertise. I believe it can be done, but you're talking about expensive engineering in your sanctuary in terms of how the room is built. And I don't even know if the big mega churches do that. The sweet spot is in a small area, so I guess you charge extra for those seats, or you have to subscribe, or so I don't know what you do in church. But, headphones, there you go. That's what you do. Everyone wears headphones. That would really make everyone feel connected. All right, a couple more review things. If you remember, sound basically is like a wave. I'm going to do this upside down. I kind of blew that. Actually, I just could draw the line, so I'm going to do that. And we go like this, and like this. Remember we talked about when you drop a rock into a pond, if it's a big rock, it creates bigger waves. That's amplitude. So when I'm talking louder, I'm pushing more air, and that's just like you throw a big rock in a pond, it'll ripple farther. Lower amplitude. In layman's terms, you're talking about audio or loudness. I mean, there is some things about in terms of how much force there is and all these mathematical things, but for our purposes here, just think of it as loudness. And then also remember, frequency is how fast it does this. And so the faster it's doing it, higher, slower it's doing it, the lower. And it also, we didn't talk about it, we don't really need to dig into it too much, but often the lower this up and down is longer too, the length of the wave is longer. But now, one of the things, watch this, if we go like this, if that's another wave, what's going to happen when that happens?
That's canceled.
Yeah, that's basically you're out of phase. We were just listening to a lecture today, and suddenly the guy's voice sounded like he was in a tunnel for a second. And I'm pretty sure what they did in the editing system is they had two channels, and during a certain section, they moved it or something, and it got it out of phase. And so it suddenly sounded like he was talking in a tunnel, and then it came back to normal. In actual fact, it wasn't that great, but it was normal.
Yes.
It was a pretty amateur kind of thing, but the concept was pretty good. So, yeah, that's out of phase. Now, I'm going to play one thing I didn't play last night, and it's related to harmonics.
It's the out of phase.
What's that?
How do you fix the out of when it's out of phase?
Well, that's a good question. Generally, you ask yourself the question, what causes the out of phase? And without getting too technical, where you can create this is, let's say you have someone playing a guitar. They're playing a guitar, and so you have a microphone up here, and you have a mic down at the guitar. If that distance is exactly right, and this isn't close enough, this mic is picking up some from the guitar. You could create a situation where it's out of phase, and so it's going to cancel it out. Now, it isn't like it makes it go away. I don't know if they still do it, but I know several years ago, Porsche used to use this as a methodology to create quieter in the car. They actually were like taking sound and trying to cancel. I don't know how they all did it, but it was kind of a cool idea. I don't know if they still do that, but like in the guitar example, it would like totally cancel it out, but if you're listening carefully, you could tell like the guitar, there's something that doesn't sound right, and it's kind of taking some of the sound off. So mic placement in that example, if you're editing or any audio editing, it's easy, you just kind of, it's where the audio is lined up and stuff like that, and that's often just an operator mistake. But probably the guitar is the best example where it's more just kind of listening for it. Mm-hmm. Because it's never, I don't think it's generally, you rarely hear it totally perfectly cancel it out. It just muffled, like I said, often what it can sound like is they're in a tunnel, for it. It just sounds really weird. Unless you want that. Which this day and age, a lot of times they do. Let me pull something up here. I'm going to play for you. I'm going to preface it by this again. Don't want you to like analyze it too much. You just hear it. And it's more of a hearing observation, if you will. Because one of the things, like yesterday when we played some of that stuff, we can go into all these complicated explanations of the EQ and stuff like that. And later this evening, I'm going to play them back again because I want to get you guys used to listening. Because that's really what it comes down to. I can stand up here and tell you, I can put a vocalist through here and I EQ it and say, this is how you do it. I bring in the next guy, he'd show it, and it sounds different. The next person, it's really a subjective thing. So the main thing is just hearing it. So at least you have some sense, I'm hearing what I'm supposed to be hearing. Now I may decide I like it sounding like this, but at least when you get that engineer with some traveling singing group that, kind of, I know everything, get out of my way, and you see him start messing with your sound system, you kind of at least can have some sense of that's not right. You know, why does my sound system suddenly sound bad? After this guy came through town, and supposedly an expert, why does my system sound bad and how can I get it back? You know, so it ultimately is a subjective thing, so just trying to give you basic principles and just start listening. One of the things here, I'm going to play a tone, and this tone is at 444 hertz. Wow, was that exciting? Now, listen to what happens. Yeah, an emergency broadcast. Yeah? I'll tell you what I'm doing here in a second. Now, listen to this one. You hear the beats? What I'm doing is the first one was 440 hertz, the next one was 445 hertz, and the next one was 450 hertz. And what's actually happening is that these waves are lining up a little differently. And this is kind of an extreme, and quite frankly, you start getting into this area, this exceeds my level of expertise. But the reason I did play it for you is that it's another example about how sounds interact and create rhythms and things like that, which can muddy up your sound. Like, I've got it right now where just the 440 hertz and the 445 hertz are together. And that's actually a 5 hertz beat, I think is how you would describe it. Now this is 450, which is 10 hertz difference. Now obviously when you're playing an instrument or something, you're not going to hear that so precisely. But it's something to be aware of in mixing your sound. And I say, well, how in the world am I going to figure that out? Well, as you start, you can find charts and different things, and you'll kind of know that, like, drums are down in these hertz, guitars are in these hertz, vocals are generally in this range. And so when you're EQing, you just kind of be aware that sounds can interact and make themselves muffled and all that kind of stuff by adjusting the frequencies in certain hertz. Clean it up. In fact, don't let me forget, before the end of the week, I'll give you a chart that kind of just says at these hertz, this is what a piano is, and they'll recommend like 3 hertz, or this is what generally makes a piano bright, and that kind of thing. It's just some basic stuff. But ultimately, that kind of thing, you got to put the sound in your church and just listen to it. And if you have time to do that, I highly recommend it. Because remember we were talking about the equalizers that have the actual faders on them? Those should be set and not touched, because those are designed to EQ the room. Before you make any other sound in there, that's what makes the room, it reacts to what the room is. Because like, I'm speaking here, I can even tell when I'm talking to you, it sounds a lot different to me right here for some reason. Now it could be because that's reflecting back, I don't know. But you can tell the acoustics in this room are not real great, but it's bouncing all over the place. And when, like, the church we had, Arlington, we have kind of one of the worst scenarios because you got a flat stage and then the edges go like this, and then the congregation goes out. So the people on the edges, it's going to be hard to give them decent sound because it's coming from who knows where. And then you got a balcony, and so you got people underneath the balcony, so you have all these situations with sound bouncing everywhere. Yeah. And then remember we talked about a couple of things that what makes one sound different than the other. In other words, what makes a trumpet sound like a trumpet versus a saxophone? And that was a combination of at least two things. One is harmonics, which is essentially what I'm playing to, like, I'm going to go down here and I'm going to play, this is kind of in the technical sense, but you've been hearing this tone, again, just trying to, kind of hearing how these waves, when we talk about it in a technical sense, right now we're just hearing it in a pure form. But well, obviously when a saxophone plays, it has some personality to it. Well, that's a combination of these harmonics with, remember, the envelope in terms of how, when a sound is made, when that wave is created, you know, what the amplitude, how fast it goes up, how long it lingers, how much it comes down, all kinds of, those are the factors. Harmonics and envelope, that envelope, remember, is what we refer to, that up, down, and then back down. That's what kind of makes the sounds different. And I promise you I wouldn't get too engineering technical. I just wanted, again, for you guys to hear that. And later, when we have a break, kind of coming back, we'll play those things we did last night so you can hear the EQ again and the phase and stuff like that. Because really it is, it sounds obvious, but often we don't do it. Sound is about listening. And then by just starting to recognize what you're listening for, you know, you say, well, that sounds good, that sounds bad. Being able to define what about that makes it sounding good and what about that, and being able to translate that. All right. That's enough for review for right now. Let's get into the video. What I'm going to do is just cover some basic video technology issues very briefly, and then I'm going to spend most of the time on kind of what the trends are right now, because I'm thinking in terms of, particularly, we haven't had a chance to talk like yet, but we talked a little bit about what they were looking for in a break. I'll talk with you as well to make sure we're covering what you want. But since you're kind of looking at how are we going to get into podcasting and how are we going to do this, what are some of the trends that are happening and how do I get into that? Because just like audio, there's an expert on every corner that gets you hooked into some funky thing and, you know, just like audio, video is even worse and it's more expensive. So when you get stuck in video, it's a whole lot worse. First of all, let's talk about the television signal. The North American system is NTSC. The joke is never twice the same color, but that's what the engineers say. But anyway, that's just, it came from some engineering group to set the standard. And most of the rest of the world is PAL, PAL. And the only reason I bring it up now is that if you are planning to send something overseas, another country or something, you need to be aware of those issues. There is a third system, CCAM, which was typically in the Russian and the old Soviet Union and all the Eastern Bloc. CCAM is almost like PAL. Like if you put a tape into a CCAM deck, it will play PAL tapes usually, but they'll be black and white. So the signal's almost the same. I think it was actually developed by the French. It was just slightly adjusted. I don't know why they made the shift, but unfortunately, North America was the first to adopt television systems. So there's a lot of things about PAL that are better, or that were better than NTSC. Fortunately, with the HD stuff that's coming in, it's kind of removing some of those issues. The other issue you have with power, video here, and with all your electronics, we're on a 60, our electricity is 60 hertz, right? Making sure I'm getting my labels right. A lot of the rest of the world is at 50. The other thing you got to watch out for is they're running 220 or 240. And so if you don't have your computer set right, you'll blow your computer or something, you'll plug it most of it. Fortunately, most of this stuff is automatically switchable and you'll get the power supplies. But anyway, I don't need to get too much into that. But we're in NTSC, and we still have quite a bit of analog stuff going over the airways, or it's analog and it goes digital. By the end of this year, I believe all television has to at least be digital. Unless they move it again for the third or fourth time. But basic way video works is there's a thing that scans across, skips a line, and scans across again. This is a good one. It's basically like a Venetian blind. And then when it gets all the way down to the bottom, then it comes up back up here and goes across and does the even lines. Now this is happening so fast, obviously you don't see it. Second of all, it's not the resolution or the size of the line is so small that if you saw only one pass, it would look like a complete picture. It's just the color would not be quite as rich. So the television system, it goes across, skips a line, goes across, skips a line, goes across, skips a line. Now basically there's this gun that's going across like this, and you know, doing this all the time. That's what's happening all the time. It's scanning back and forth, so on and so forth. Well, one of the things, when this scans across and the gun has to come back, they send a signal. Like let's say this is it's a picture of the sky with ocean down here. So this line, you would see the blue sky at the top of the picture. When it goes back, it actually sends a black signal to that gun. So when it's going back across, there's still a signal there. It doesn't just turn off. If an engineer, he would like murder me. I'm oversimplifying it, but this is all you really need to know. So trust me, there's a lot of stuff I'm skipping or oversimplifying that I'm sure you'll appreciate. It's like, great. But basically, there's a gun that goes across to make sure it doesn't actually have no signal. Otherwise, it would flicker. And then also, when it has to come back up to the top, one of the things you will encounter in video is they'll talk about Genlock, black burst, sync. What they're talking about is this right here. Think of it as a metronome. When you hook up all your equipment to Genlock, it means all of them are getting that black burst, that's what it's called, a black burst at the same time. If you don't have it genlocked, particularly when you're if you're switching cameras from one camera to the other, or even switching anything, you will see a roll usually. Not always. Sometimes it'll line up okay and you're lucky. Other times it'll come in, or sometimes what you'll have happen is you'll be looking at a monitor or your projector in your church, and the signal shifts up and it won't come down. And you can kind of start again. It'll sometimes lock in at the right spot. But it's kind of a random kind of thing. So they use the term sync. The most common broadcast term is genlock, black burst. Often you purchase a black burst generator or a sync generator to hook up to your system. Now, kind of the good news is that a lot of the new kind of, like we're going to look at this camera over here, a lot of them, they don't require the sync, the genlock. They're kind of designed to kind of sync up on their own. They're kind of designed for the not just the pure consumer, but someone that's not a professional either, that you know has all the money for all the gear and all that kind of stuff. And so fortunately, a lot of that stuff you can often get by, or some of the less expensive switchers that you might use in your church, AV switchers, they don't require it, or they'll sync up on their own. But you just need to be kind of aware of it, so when you're starting, you buy some smaller cameras, you don't have the problem, and then suddenly, hey, we're going to expand, and suddenly, why are we having all these problems? Be aware of genlock. We'll look at a spigot on this camera over here. But that's probably one of the basic things. Now, your computer monitor doesn't do this. It's what's called progressive. And it basically goes first line, second line, third line, all the way down to the bottom. And you might ask the question, why didn't they do that when they made television? Why did they do this? They call it interlacing bundle. So like when you go to Circuit City or Best Buy and they say it's 1080i, the I stands for interlacing. That's what this is. The reason they did this is because it was a way of compression. In other words, when they're sending the signal out over the airwaves, they're actually sending half of the picture at a time. So the first part of the picture is every other line odd, and then the second half of the picture is even. So that was one of the ways they were able to reduce how much, frequency or how much bandwidth they needed. Because obviously, you needed to get it over the airwaves, period, and then you wanted to have as many channels as possible. So that's why they did that. The other problem, and this was the more important problem initially, is that the original televisions, they had phosphor on it, and a gun was shooting at it, and the way it worked, when electricity hit it, it would cause it a color. And so as it was going across, well, if they did it in progressive, when it got down to the bottom, it would start dimming. So it would hit the electricity and go boom, show the light, and then it'd start to dim. Well, if it went progressive all the way down, when it got down to the bottom, this side would dim and it would actually cause a flicker. So that was the other reason they needed to get the gun back up to the top sooner, so they took the flicker off. So this is interlacing, and your computer monitor is progressive. Now, they're starting to introduce more and more into cameras. Even your consumer cameras, they're going to say, well, you've heard of 1080i probably, or they'll say 720p. And let me explain the difference of that, or the relevance. Sony, generally, their HD is 1080i. So, and what that 1080, by the way, it references the number of lines. Like our current television system, your regular television, is 525 lines. And we actually only see at least 480. They use, like, I'm showing you these lines. They're numbered, 525. They use some of those lines, like, for example, closed captioning goes into a line, and there's some other broadcasting information stuff that goes down, time code can go into those lines, stuff like that. But our standard system is 525 lines. Well, HD goes up to 1080. Or 720p, 1080i, or 720p. Obviously, if you have more lines, you can have a better picture. There's more information. Well, one of the confusing things, though, and there's kind of a battle, is that 1080i is what Sony kind of pushed, and then Panasonic pushed 720. And you say, well, Sony must be better because it's 1080 lines. But it's interlaced, so actually you're only seeing half of those lines at a time. Whereas Panasonic at 720p, more like your computer, so you're seeing all 720 lines. And so I personally like the 720p better for another reason. I don't know if they're still doing it, but like Fox Sports and stuff, they generally do 720p. And there's a reason for that. In there. Envision this. If you're going across and you skip a line, and one thing I failed to mention, when it goes down like on the odd lines, that's called a field. And then when it comes up, so there's field one and field two. So it takes two fields to make one complete television frame. Okay? Well, if this is taking time to scan, and this is interlaced, imagine what it looks like if you're following a race ball across. You're panning quickly. If you're still, this line and this line are going to look the same. But if you're shooting something that's really fast, this line, whatever you're shooting, is going to be over here. So it's going to be slightly off. It gets blurrier. Well, in the HD, because there's more information, there's more lines to scan, that's a real problem. It's, you can see the stutter. Because it's, I mean, obviously, it's, this thing is happening so fast we don't see most of it, but that's one of the problems. And so when you use 720p, you're seeing the whole frame, so you're not going to get that jittery. Some of that interlacing, if you've ever watched like a cheesy commercial, often you'll see the text and stuff looks a little funky. Sometimes that's an interlaced problem. Or you also have that problem if you're going from NTSC to PAL, the way the interlacing and stuff works and so forth. But the main thing to be aware of is what the difference of I and P is. That's as far as you need to know. Yeah.
So you just use the P for action pretty much? Or
well, that's how it was originally kind of marketed. Now, most cameras will do all of it. But yes, if you were to use it for some kind of action situation, you'd want to use the 720p. The other thing is, it becomes, it's kind of like Sam, it's like you kind of decide what you think looks better. And one of the things that's confusing, you go to like the Best Buy in Circuit City, and they'll say, we've got a 1080p monitor. But there's nothing that will generate 1080p. Now Sony is coming out, in fact, I believe they have a new little camera I think might do 1080p. I haven't checked into it enough, but this EX1 I think either is going to or does. But for the longest time, you know, you go to the Circuit City or Best Buy or some of these things, and you know, the quote expert will come in and say, hey, there's a 1080p. Oh, great, I'm getting a 1080p. But no one broadcasts 1080p. It's either going to be 1080i or 720. That's it. And so it gets a little confusing. It's kind of like, remember when the word digital, everything was digital. Or like, I still don't know what they mean by it said as HD ready. I mean, I know the different options that could mean, but which option are they picking? Does that mean that if I go buy this expensive tuner, they can output an analog signal, then it's HD ready? Which some of them, that's how they were selling it. You know, others, you know, you could put in a straight HD signal on there. They've got the thing there. So it's really misleading and so on and so forth. Another aspect that's gotten a little confusing. Well, before I move on, any questions on that? Basically, all you need to know is HD, there's 720p, 1080i, and maybe they're going to have 1080p. But just understand what the difference is, progressive versus interlaced. And you won't encounter it a lot, but as you can see with the interlace, there's some issues that you may see some jagged lines and stuff like that, particularly in your text. It may be an interlace problem. When you get into editing systems, you'll see de-interlacing and all this kind of stuff. 99% of the time, you'll never touch that, so I'm not going to get into it, but you shouldn't have to deal with it. Let's talk about... let me mention about HD. Basically, if you're going to buy any video equipment, you need to be prepared for HD. We already know when you walk out of the store with a computer, it's dated. It's old technology. I mean, you don't even get out of the store. Well, cameras, it's almost worse. But so at this point, if you're not doing HD, you're going to be replacing it. Because more and more, your television, a lot of them, when they're going digital, they're going ahead because of the money that's spent for digital, they're going HD. Yeah, they're doing the whole thing. So, one of the things I might mention on that is that even if your intention is just podcasting or you know, you want to broadcast on local access like you were talking,
They're not going to be HD. Probably, I think it's actually a bigger problem. They're not going to be HD and say, well, why should I bother? Okay, let's say, you know, your favorite preacher comes into town, or speaker, or whatever, and you take that person, and 3 years later, you want to use that, and now it is HD. You're stuck. No. Well, you're not totally stuck, but you can up-res it, and you know, take it from the lower resolution up, and it doesn't look great. So, even if your current application isn't HD, it kind of extends the life of it. I'll give you an example. A lot of my background, I spent about 10 years in Hollywood, and one of the shows I worked on was ER, and when the first things talking about HD came out, no one knew which format was going to settle. In fact, it still isn't totally settled, but it's kind of clarified. Because Japan was pushing one signal because that's what they built, and Japan had HD years before we did. And then the French had one, and I think Danish had one, and you know, and there were all these little nuances and stuff. So no one went, should I save it on this kind of HD and stuff? So what they did uniquely on ER is they shoot those shows, or they used to, more they're going to HD now, but they would shoot them on film. And then generally they would edit them on video. Well, what ER did is they actually took the film and they edited the film and then copied that to video. So whenever the format got figured out, they could just put the film up, and they call it telecine, where they transfer the film to video. They could transfer it to any format they want because they have the film and that was already HD, if you will. That was their way of making sure their material would have a long lifespan. I worked with It Is Written for a little bit. They had a lot of old shows that were on 2-inch video. There are companies now that you could go, you spend quite a bit of money, but they have some of the remaining 2-inch machines, and they have a bunch of them in a warehouse that they keep pulling spare parts off of. You know, and people are coming, copying off these old shows, and then there's 1-inch, there's 3/4, there's Betacam, there's DigiBeta. I mean, the format's just, I've been working, you know, 25, going on 30 years, just in my short span, the number of formats that are out there that have been used is ridiculous. And in the last few years, it's gotten crazy. So, that whole explanation, bottom line, go HD, extend the life of your even the cheap little camera is better than going to the standard definition. Now, let's talk about what defines something as HD. Before I do that, you've probably seen HD, you know, say this is HD, and then you'll hear, here's HDD. And then Panasonic's is like, HDC now, or maybe that's an AVX HD, and then there's a whole bunch of others. You know, what in the planet is that? Well, to kind of simplify that, and to be honest with you, this I finally was able to sort this out about a year ago, so it was kind of a new thing to me. But, basically, HD has some simple criteria. It has to be 16 by 9. It has to either be 1080 or 720. If it falls within that criteria, it's HD. You say, well, so what? What you'll find out is there are all kinds of different HDs, that they're different. They have different picture qualities, but they all can say they're HD. It's because they fall within this specification. So it's a little bit like this is what defines it's a car. But you have one with a V8, you have one with a V6. Basic principle, you get in, you turn the key, and you go. It depends how fast you go. In this case, it's how good the picture is versus how big the file is. So
let's talk about a couple of formats. How many of, like, your video camera, did you have a mini DV camera? You might have a mini DV, a few of you have a mini DV camera. Hi8? Yeah. VHS? Yeah. You know, this annoys my wife a lot. You know, since I, when we go on trips and stuff, I don't like to take pictures. I don't take video cameras. It's too much like work for me. I don't enjoy it. And I always use the line, it's like, you know, if I'm at the Grand Canyon, I'm at the Grand Canyon. I want to look at, I don't want to look at the Grand Canyon through a TV, you know, an eyepiece kind of thing. Fortunately, she takes the pictures and stuff, and I'm always glad she did, you know, think of that little memory. But one of the things with the whole HD signal thing is that what they're trying to do, the reason there's so many different things, is they're ultimately trying to get the highest quality picture in the smallest amount of space. I asked about the mini DV and all that kind of stuff. Videotape originally was 2-inch, and then they took it down to 1-inch, and they took it down to 1/2-inch. And if you remember when VHS came out, there was another format called Betamax. It was kind of listed as one of the biggest blunders by Sony. Basically, they were greedy, and they lost, because Betamax was actually better than VHS, but VHS charged less to license it. And Sony lost. On the broadcast side, Sony won. Betacam, which is kind of the same thing, it was on a 1/2-inch tape as well, it had some other stuff, was, you know, was really the standard for a lot of years. And then they got went to digital Betacam. And that's the main thing. What was happening is you had all these analog, you know, VHS, SVHS, they all ultimately were analog. And the biggest thing about that is whenever you needed to copy that tape, every time you copied it, it would reduce the quality. As soon as they got to digital, you had ways of making copies that at first it wouldn't be quite as much, and you could make several copies before it really went bad. Well, if you remember the VHS, well, let me just say, first there's this analog to digital problem. They wanted to get, you know, better picture quality, and you could make copies and it wouldn't degrade so much. The other problem was size. And the reason I asked about the VHS, I remember people walking around in these big hunking things, you know, and that was definitely, you know, I'm going on vacation, that is not vacation. You know, I get a kick, I still see a few people out there, you know, they're going on a roller coaster, and it's like, I hope you don't get killed, you know, the thing flying around a little bit. But the reason they had to be that big is to get all the data. They needed the tape as big as they possibly could. In fact, one of the things that video does when they put it on tape is, say this is the tape, they don't lay it down vertically, it gets laid down on an angle. That's how they got more data on the tape. And then often your audio tracks are like up here, and we'll talk about time code in a second. Time codes and other things down there. Well, if you had 4 tracks of audio, it's not good. But the big issue was getting a lot of information onto as small a space possible. But one of the first innovations was DV. That was a digital format that you did on a small tape. Now Sony had two types. They had DV Cam, which was kind of their professional version. It was a larger size tape. In other words, you could get 2 hours on that. But I think the largest you could get on mini DV was like 64 minutes or something like that. Well, that was the great innovation, getting from analog to digital, and so you could get these little cameras now. It wasn't the big hunk of things. And, you know, then, like even someone like me, that, you know, it's like you could put them in your backpack or something like that, and you weren't carrying this hunk of things. So that was the goal. Well, that goal is still there when you're getting into HD. But the problem they had is when you're going from 525, well, DV actually was 480, to all of a sudden jump up to 1080. How are you going to fit that on a small little tape? well, they couldn't. So Sony and several other manufacturers, they came out with HD. And so what they did is they found a form of compression, which basically the compression is, again, it's another area where an engineer would come in, but think of it this way. There are a variety of ways to do it, but it's like, how can we take this picture or these groups of pictures, you know, your video, and how can we remove data, or how much stuff can we remove and it still looks fine? That's really what compression is. And then they have a gazillion different ways they do it. Well, one of the ways, so that was going on with HDV. They came up with a way to still stay within this standard, and initially it was 1080, but HDV, that they found a way to take away some of the data so they could fit it on the small tape and still be HD. And if you saw mini DV versus HDV, it looks significantly different. Well, Panasonic has come out with this other format. There's more formats coming out. And that's the reason I bring this up, because there's more coming. And it's, so what is that? The main thing, okay, it's HD. I get that part, all right. Well, they're using different compressions, and this is where you come into some problems. Like the HDV, one of the ways they solve, way they take information away, there's two basic things they do. One of those things is like your DVD. You've probably at least heard the term MPEG, and this is going to become relevant to your podcasting as well. MPEG 2, there's MPEG 1, MPEG 2, MPEG, and we kind of skipped the 4. Basically, MPEG, I'm pretty sure that stands for some society that decided the standard. Right? I don't remember what it is. But the DVDs that you're watching are MPEG 2s, you know, your standard definition of MPEG 2. Well, one of the ways they could get the information onto that disk is the MPEG compression is they take one frame. And I think MPEG 2 is 10 frames. ACP, I think, uses 15. But I don't remember this exact, the number of frames. But basically, it takes one frame and it assumes the next 10 frames are the same. So it essentially removes a lot of the information from the rest of these frames. So, for example, if you have a sky and the water, it will grab some of the information from the movement down here, you know, in the water, but up above, it's kind of assuming that's all the same. And so it really only keeps the information from that first frame until it changes. And believe me, I'm oversimplifying it, but it's all you really need to understand what's going on. Because I'll bring it up when we talk about editing, because that MPEG is an issue. And HDV creates that issue a little bit. HDV does the same thing. That's one of the ways they save space, is that they assume a certain number of frames are going to be the same. They call it GOT, is the term they'll use, a group of, I forget what P is, but it's basically a group of frames. So GOT. And the new HD stuff, particularly a lot of the QuickTime, Apple worked with them, and that became MPEG-4 is basically something Apple had a lot to do with developing, but somehow they got it passed through everybody. But the MPEG group approved the MPEG-4 standard, which is the HD version of it. And I believe Blu-ray is a derivative of that. I haven't gotten into the Blu-ray too much, but we'll talk about that in a second. So that's one of the way they do that compression. Another way they do it is color sampling. And I'm not going to get into this much because I myself haven't found any engineer, and I've asked 5 or 6 engineers, I've read probably 10 different websites, 5 different books to find a clear explanation of this, and I haven't found it. I mean, if I need calculus in some other form, I maybe can figure it out. But basically, in essence, what they do, I know what it does in terms of the end thing, but it basically color sampling. You'll see a camera; they'll list it as 422 or 444 or 410. And I wouldn't bring this up because it is a pretty technical term, and no one seems to really be able to explain it well. But it is becoming more and more common when you're looking at a camera, they're going to tell you this. And I just wanted you to at least know kind of a general idea of what they're telling you and what the impact it has on it. A number of years ago, the new Star Wars, particularly the last one, was shot entirely HD. It used an HD camera that's 422. And basically, in most simplest terms, this is representing how many colors it samples in some different channels and stuff. You'd say, well, why don't they use 444? But basically 444 means they're capturing everything. Well, the first camera that had 444, there was literally a rack this big that you had to walk around. So you can imagine going into Morocco, where there's a lot of Star Wars, you know, bringing this whole big computer and getting attached to power somewhere. That wasn't practical. If I remember right, HDV is 410. The bottom line is, we're going to talk a little bit about tonight about some video applications for podcasting, and one of those things is green screen. One of the great little tools that you want to do, like say your pastor, you want to do just little devotionals, a little talk. You can be in a room way smaller than this, have a green cloth like this hanging up, and you can put them on a really nice background. And you just have a light set in there, and they just walk in and you can shoot it real quick. You don't have to have a whole big team. And so it's a real useful tool to make something look really nice, really fast, theoretically. when you get an HDV, because of this color sampling, the way that works, suffice to say, when you're looking at the picture, let's say I'm standing here, and this shirt would be awful with green screen, but let's say my arm's here. You would look at the picture and you'd see clearly my arm. But if you zoom way in, you'll discover that that is not a clean line. And what that sampling, bottom line, what it's doing, it's averaging. It's saying, well, we're guessing this is going to be this, we're guessing it's going to be that. We're just going to kind of average it. We're going to estimate it to complete the picture. In other words, we're going to get rid of this information. And then, from the picture, we're going to get rid of it, and now we're going to calculate what we think it was. And so it's always guessing. And so when you look, really zoom in, this is like a jagged edge, and it's not a defined color. Well, with green screen, what it's doing, basically, is you tell your editing system, everywhere you see that color, make it go away. Well, if on my arm, this pixel is my arm, and the next one is the green screen, and the next one's my arm, and the next one's the green screen, it's going to have a hard time figuring out where the edge is. And there's all these programs that are trying to figure out how to do that, and you can sort of do it. But it's a bear, and it's one of those things where you say, oh, wow, let's do green screen, this is really cool. We can do that, we can do it in the pastor's office or whatever. And then you start working with it, and it's like, man, it just looks awful. I can't get it to work. Why can't I get it to work? That's one of the downsides of HDV or any of these other. And that's why I even go into some of this. Just be aware that there's this form of compression that's an issue. Now, we're going to talk in a second here about some differences in the cameras here. And you'll be able to flexi formats that that's not an issue, and they're becoming affordable and all that kind of stuff. But let me just summarize this. HD, even if it's a dinky camera, go HD. If you want to do some green screen, we'll talk about, again, a little later in the podcast, why you might want to do this, some green screening and stuff like that. You're going to want to try and avoid the HDV stuff. You may not be able to do that, and you can do the green screen stuff. You'll just have to accept some issues, and for some people, it's fine. In fact, we'll show you a thing we did in a little bit. Any questions on that?
Yeah. So avoid the HDV and avoid all of those, or just the HDV?
You know, I probably shouldn't let you go away thinking that. If just be aware there are new formats coming. HDV is dicey with if you want to use green screen. But in terms of, if you're not using that and you're shooting the church service, HDV looks great. It's a great format. It's just Sony is moving away from it right now, and I don't know what they're going to end up doing. Because they're coming out with their, what do they call it now? It's XD, it's like a version of their XD camera. I don't know, who knows what this is. They've got some cool cameras coming out, and they have a new HD format that's kind of derivative.
But, I mean, is the AVX HD, is that any better for this, or does it matter?
You know, I haven't tried it. So it's a relatively new thing. Randy has one of the new little cameras. I mean, they're really small, and they store them in the little, like, cars. It's really pretty cool. I don't know yet. I haven't dug into it, but it's getting a lot of good reviews.
I do want to ask you about that, and we may come to that in another section, but I think because of the transition to HD, and now we have more consumer HD cameras, a lot of people who don't have a big budget are trying to create a type of production setup with cameras like that one. What's your caution on that?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, if you have a bad picture, you go to HD, it's just a clearer bad picture. You don't want to forget that. I mean, it's like one of the things, like in the television industry, like we did a little bit of work on Jay Leno's set. You go on the set looks old, beat up, and you know, and you see it on TV, it's like, it looks great. When they switched to HD, it couldn't be that anymore. They had to turn it up, because you can see it. And it was an issue that all these shows that were going to HD now, where they kind of, you don't have to worry about it too much now, they had to worry about it. So when you're shooting in your church and you go to HD, you're going to notice the scuff mark possibly, you know, that's there. And so you need to be aware of that. And, and just be conscious, because your church may look better in not HD format for a while, you know. So it's just a caution that you'll notice things more. When someone leaves something on the stage, someone leaves music or stuff like that, you're going to see it more, and it's going to stand out more. So you have to be more conscious of that kind of stuff. That's the main thing. The other thing, one of the challenges when you go with these little cameras, it's hard to hold them steady. And that's probably the biggest thing. It's like if someone gets their little tiny camera and it produces a great picture, but, you know, they're trying to make a church service out of it, you know, you put it on a tripod, but then if you put it on a proper tripod that'll make it smooth, it's so light, you know, it doesn't help. So then you go with an inexpensive tripod, and then it's so light, it's hard to hold it steady. You just kind of have to leave it there. And I should mention, like I said last night, I think it was, because I come from more of a broadcast background, I mentioned last night, like, I won't do weddings, you know, because no matter what I do, they can't afford to do it professionally, and so it all looks bad to me. You know, it's not good quality. Well, I mention that now again, where you need to interpret yourself what's good enough for you.
because I may say some things that it's not good enough for me, and, you know, it's a subjective thing. And I will at least try and suggest, hey, if you really want to represent your church well, and, you know, particularly when you're getting on the airwaves, there's all kinds of churches getting on the airwaves, and they have multi-million dollar budgets, and you are competing against that. So you want to make sure, if you're going to put something out there, it doesn't do you a disservice, because it isn't done well. And also, like I said, I believe if we put everything we have, and this is the best we got, God blesses that. But I also believe He inspires us to keep growing and improving and learning and solving them. Now, granted, there's a lot of people that have a lot of money producing church shows that they still look expensively bad, you know. So,
how much difference is there between, because when I was looking at a B&H catalog, and there's a lot, there's a pretty big range in price between these little cameras and the bigger cameras. I mean, how much actual picture quality difference are you going to see, assuming you can get stabilized?
It's a good question, and there's a few things you're looking for. I'm going to say something, and then I'm going to contradict it after I get done. But I'll just say it. Pretty much, you want a three-chip camera to start right there. If you go with a single chip, that takes the quality way down. And the reason there's three chips is that it splits the color into red, green, blue. And so you're going to have, that's going to take the camera up a notch, just that alone. Now, the contradiction I'm going to make to that is the trend right now is they're coming out with these single CMOS chips. And that's different. And a lot of the digital cameras now, still cameras, they're putting these CMOS in. And what the significance of is that they are a single chip, and they're also getting them the size of a 35mm film, where, like, the chips and even the big broadcast cameras are only a half inch in size, and, you know, an actual film frame is much bigger than that. But until those become kind of standard in the small, like I said, as soon as I say get a three chip, I'm going to contradict. That's something that's happening right now, and so at least be aware. And so you go to a place to buy a camera, you say, all right, I want a three chip. They quote you out. Now, what about the single chip, the CMOS I've heard about? Let them explain it to you, whatever it is that day, you know, because it is changing that rather. In fact, I think the little Panasonic may be a CMOS, the one in the rain. I'm not sure. And there's a new kind of high-end camera that's got a single, and it's kind of a rave right now. It's for a different purpose than for churches and stuff. But three chips. The other thing is the lens. If you have a good chip and a bad lens, it's kind of a waste. But, you know, most of that, generally if you go to a three chip, they're going to put some kind of lens on it that, you know, most of us aren't going to notice the difference. And it's fine. One of the factors is whether you can remove the lens or not, and someone will try and tell you that, you know, removing the lens is really crucial. For most of the stuff you're doing, it won't. In fact, I know guys that own video cameras that can remove lenses and they never remove them, unless they're broken. You know, there are reasons why you would do that, but they're very high-end reasons, and most people aren't doing that. Like, the big selling point for these JVCs is you can remove the lens. And there are people that do, but most don't. They know they can, but they don't. The other thing is, some of the connections that they have on them. And, you know, at minimum, of course, they need to have FireWire. I think most of them do now, but anyone doesn't. And that's pretty crucial. But one of the things, like the new Sony camera that they're coming out with, it has some pretty professional connections. Like I was talking about Genlon, that's kind of when you need. As soon as you start seeing those kind of terms on the camera, you'll, B&H, you'll see if you looked at the specs, you'll suddenly say it'll have SDI or Genlock. You'll see that's one of the features that suddenly makes it neat. And this is probably a good time. Let me break out some of the options in terms of a video and what the differences are.
But real quick.
Yeah.
What about the lenses, like the target lenses?
Well, you know, Leica has a great reputation, and it probably is a good lens. They make the lens for this camera. And it's a little bit like if you go to... think of some kind of fancy brand, and Kmart has it, or Costco is a better example. A manufacturer, a brand name, they'll make a different thing for Costco. So it's kind of using the brand name as a whole thing. Like if you see a TV in Costco, it's either a discontinued model generally, or you know, it's made especially. And so you know, they don't really tell you that, but that's generally. I don't know that that's always true, but that's often. So Leica is a good brand. This one has a Fuji, but, well, this is a good example. This has a Fuji lens. Almost all the broadcast cameras I've used in the field are on the Fuji. There's some that have cameras, but most of them have Fuji. This lens is made specifically for this camera. It's a lot less quality than the Fuji lenses I've used. Now, even myself, you really don't notice the difference that much. I mean, you can go on forums, and these guys will talk about lenses. These are guys that like know the calculation of each element in the lens, and they can tell you what it's doing. You know, I'm just not at that level, and don't have an interest in that level. One of the areas you do know is like when you're doing like zoom control. We were talking about the other day. A better lens zooms in a little better and holds focus, and it's a little sharper and all that kind of stuff. You have to leap quite a bit, and you'll see it's a big difference. But for what most of you guys are going to be doing, it's not worth spending the money, you know, and the money that you need to spend to really see the difference is ridiculous. So, like to get a really good lens on this costs, you know, probably $10,000, $12,000, $15,000, and it's more than the camera cost. So it's and it does the trick. Does that answer your question about, you know, it's kind of hard to say those are good lenses. Pretty much you read the reviews, and often the people that are making the reviews, like the professionals, even they're not really used to working. They're kind of, you know, you kind of have to take that with a grain of salt. But if you read enough of them, if the average is pretty positive, you can accept, you know, it's, because also, you know, one of the things people, you know, probably you guys realize it, that one of the companies started was called LA Digital, and we became a pretty big editing rental company in Hollywood. And there's a magazine, a popular magazine called Post Magazine. Well, and this is kind of my background, by the way, is journalism. That's my degree. And when I was taking journalism, the whole thing was objectivity. You know, that's gone out the window. And through, you know, there's so many things done on news now that is not objective, and you know, it's like they've forgotten that aspect entirely. I bring it up though, when you're reading these magazines, Post Magazine, which is a very popular magazine, I walk into the office one morning and I find out that we have an article in Post Magazine about our company. Well, there was a guy that we hired that we're having a little bit of trouble with, that had some connections, and talked to someone at one of the writers at this magazine, and he told them all these things we were going to do. Now, most of it we were planning to do, but we were going to do it in partnership because some of the things he said we were going to do would be in direct competition with the very companies that we were generating a lot of money from. And so we intended to partner with them and work this out. Well, out comes this article that's stating all these things we're going to do, and some of it we weren't planning to do. It was things he was an engineer, and that's what he wanted to do. So they never talked to us. They published this article, and that same day, I just happened to see the article. I didn't know it was in there. I was just looking through it, and I found it. It's like, hey, it's on LA Digital. What's this? You know? And I get a phone call that day, and it's from their
advertising department wanting us to buy an amp. Did you see the article? And the guy said, well, I said, no, or yeah, I did, but, you know, it's not really accurate. And he kind of, oh, really? Well, you want to buy an amp? You know, and then we kind of, they were trying to correct it. We were working with another manufacturer. They literally sent us a thing with quotes and said, would you say this? And the bottom line, where the magazine, most of the magazine have gotten, they're really PR pieces. It's very hard to find real discerning, because you think about it, the people that are paying for the magazine are the very people they need to tell, say their stuff is junk. So you need to, fortunately with some of the, you know, people reviewing with the internet and all that kind of stuff, that helps a little bit. But even that, you know, these companies have strategic ways that they, you know, if you drill down on some of the people reviewing and stuff, you may find out there's a marketing department or something. Yeah. So it's really hard to get discerning information. But if you consume enough of it, there is kind of a general term. And more there's podcasts coming out. People are, they're not dependent on that stuff. So, but just be cautious of that. It's very hard to find that discerning. Let me briefly talk about kind of some of the different levels, and then we'll take a break. Let me describe a couple of assumptions, and then I'll describe how. Let's make an assumption that your first goal is all you want to do is you want to videotape the sermon, the preacher up there preaching, and you want to put it on the web. There's nothing wrong with buying a single camera and putting it in the center of the room. If you get a decent audio level from, don't take it off the camera mic, a decent audio level from the mixing board, put it into the camera. So you need a camera that will take a professional level audio coming in. There's nothing wrong with doing just that. And you can go, I would say when you're buying a camera, don't go below about 3,000. Ideally, if you go around 4 or 5, but don't go below around 3, because that'll at least have some professional controls on it and stuff like that. Now you might be able to find things used and so on and so forth. Particularly if you do decide not to do the HD thing, you can buy some good cameras for less. But you can just start with that. The next thing you can do, and then you can do this with a second camera or a third camera, or you know how many you want, but you can put a second one out there and you can make it so you have some different angles, right? Well, the cheap way to do that is that you basically, let's just assume you do 3. So you put one over here, you put one here, you put one over there, and you put tape in them, and just record. You can take them to an editing system and then link them all back up, and there's some techniques we'll talk about how you can do that. And then you can edit that. Now, the downside of that, of course, is that if it's a weekend seminar and you have 15 hours of lecture, you got to digitize that 15 hours 3 times. And then you have to edit it, so you could be talking about days and days and days. But when you consider the cost to do the next level, you'd say, you know what, I'll spend the days, you know. Because when you start getting into the switching, it can get really expensive to do it right. And then the next level is where you have 3 cameras that they're connected to a switcher, and a little bit we'll go back there and we'll look at a couple of samples of the switcher. And what that switcher does is basically you can sit there, pick camera 1, switch to camera 2, and you can record to something, and when you're done, it's done. And the ideal of that, of course, is if you want to be able to provide, for example, a DVD. I think Fort Worth First, they actually record straight to a a DVD, and so they have a duplicator, and they can provide you a DVD right away. And I know they have these kind of small cameras, and often there's no banner, they just lock them off. And so the quality isn't great, but they're kind of, I think, mostly trying to use it in-house, and it does a thing to do. But that's the way they have some little switcher back there, and it's going straight to a DVD recorder, and then they have a duplicator, and then just put in a duplicator. I personally wouldn't want to do it that way, but that is definitely affordable. And if that's what you got, you know, better than that. And like I said, I think their primary service is, you know, but that switching, the advantage of that is that you are done with it, or you're close to done with it. Now, one of the advantages is that when some of the early shows worked on, we used to, you know, bring in a 40-foot truck. You know, it was $3,500 a day, you know, and you have four cameras or something like that, and you did three. Camera was like $1,000 a day for cameras like that. Well, what you would do is you would switch, and it would record to what they call a line cut. And that's, you know, whatever they did, that's what they recorded. If it's live, you make mistakes. So you would have a backup, and they would call that an ISO reel. And so the reason it's called an ISO reel is that if they would pick a camera, or there's ways you could change it. We'll just say for now, for illustration purposes, you pick one camera that generally would be like a wide shot, but that was recording all the time. And it was isolated, so ISO reel. Well, you'd say, well, why don't you ISO all the cameras? Well, the deck was $500 a day. So if you have a camera, you know, the camera's $1,000 a day, you add the deck, $500, you know, you have $1,500 a day for a camera, you know, it's pretty expensive, and if you're a tuner, you know, money that you have. Well, so you create this ISO reel. Well, what's great now is a lot of the cameras that you would be looking at are camcorders, which means that they can record on their own. So, like what we do is we actually record in the cameras as well as make the line. Why do we do that? Well, if we have any problems with the line, but also when you're doing live and let's say, a common thing if there's some music and there's a bridge, like one of the things I like to do is I'll often read the camera on the cams. So I have, because on those bridges I know there's something going on. Because, you know, you have people up there singing and then they're waiting. You know, what do you show? You know, you're sitting there watching people where they have this beautiful piano kind of thing going on, so and so forth. Well, let's say you don't get over there, or you know, that type of thing, and you don't switch it in time. Because sometimes you'll get a violin does just a little thing or something like that. You don't get over there, so you don't switch it. The camera's on it, but you don't switch it. Well, if you're recording each of the cameras, you can go back and just insert that shot. So that's an advantage. And also, you know, you're using a lot of volunteers, and some know how to operate. You may be using a camera, you know, or they zoomed in, oh, what are you doing, you know, you have some place to go. And famous story, my very first job, I was working as a stage manager, camera operator, TV news, and there was this kid that, unfortunately, was kind of arrogant, and unfortunately, he was kind of an arrogant Christian, and he tried to witnessed everybody, and several people were pretty offended. It was kind of an awkward situation. Well, this guy would tend to fall asleep while he was running camera. And one time, this is during a live newscast, primetime view, one of the techniques, the way you focus your camera, particularly on an individual, you zoom in and you focus it right there. Well, he wakes up. This is live. This is going out to the whole area there. He wakes up just when the director is cutting to him, and he decides he needs to check his focus. So the director cuts to him just as you see this no shot of the
the anchor, and this particular director, there's one I never worked for him, he was called Screamin' Jack. And his specialty was tennis, and all he did was scream. This director was just the opposite. His name was Andy. He was like, one, and one, and by with a roll tape, calm and mellow. When that happened, he cussed this guy out through the entire broadcast. He said, stand by, everyone. What the blankety blank? He said, you stand by. We're going to give coming up. We're back down on two. We're going to commercial. 5, 4, 3, 2. Okay, what the? You know, it was pretty, he didn't say the guy didn't come back the next day, so it's pretty ugly. But, so again, single camera, two cameras that you have to edit, third, you switch, okay? And let's take a break now, because there's a couple of things I want to show you. Ryan's coming down. I'm going to show you presentation software, PowerPoint, only it's PowerPoint on steroids. This happens to be a Mac-based one. We were on a PC-based one. We've shifted to this. There are some other PC-based ones still out there, but there's some reasons why we chose this one. And one of the things that's it's better than like a PowerPoint or something like that is we run video through it. We run words through it. We run text through it. You know, and we can combine a lot of stuff, and it really brings it all down to one place. So he's going to give us a little demo on that. Also, we have our kind of switcher thing in here. We'll be able to show you kind of some of the stuff like that. And then we'll talk about these cameras here. And we'll talk a little bit about some editing too. All right? Let's take a 5-minute break here, and we'll get back at it. And their audio room is in their laundry room, where they mix the audio, or they have a Mac where they edit video, and I've seen her on CNN. They're going to be traveling the country, they're showing up at NAB, and they're doing it out of their apartment. And they're getting ready to buy an RV and kind of travel around and do their podcast on the road. And they got sponsors and all that. Like I said, I don't think they're making like a killing for them, but I mean, you think about it, just what a great gig.
Yeah.
You know, and you see all the cool gadgets and stuff like that. So, but, and you know, podcasting, you know, they find out iTunes and all that stuff, it's free. You know? And for the longest time, they wanted to, when you go to iTunes and then you select AT podcast, they were here. There was only like 12 or so listed, and they were in that list. Now I noticed they're like page 3 or something. But then they've been able to get interviews with some pretty famous people and stuff like that. And, you know. But it's real homespun, which is what I like it. All right. Give my 2 minutes. Yeah. Yeah. Talk about the lows in the picture. With the whole web, and like we were talking last night, you know, once they solve the problem of you driving your car and you can access the internet, then it's going to change everything. Now, any radio station, you know, anybody anywhere can have a radio station. But even, you know, a lot of the cities are trying to own Wi-Fi and things, so at least you have internet access sitting in the park or whatever. John, do you have any cameras to picture?
Yeah, just one camera.
Is it like a mini TV or?
No, it's little.
Okay.
It's the pastures.
How many?
About 75. What is that?
Is that a regular camera? Is that a regular camera?
Where are you actually located?
Northwest Fort Worth, Lake Worth, you know where Lake Worth is at.
I personally feel in the area allowing the church to grow, or the techniques, whatever methodology you can grow your church, the media, particularly local church media, is not even being attacked. Because, you know, like we talked about, the internet gives you access to people, not only to people that are part of your congregation, but even to your own congregation. If you put information up there, video content, bio content, your ability to interface with your congregation, particularly if it's done consistently, is huge. You know, that's one of the things we're doing at Arlington, where we launched this huge internet thing. And it's not that, we're pretty particular about it, it's not that we're like, oh, this is some great innovative thing. It part of it is like, well, why didn't we do this before? Because it doesn't require a big church to do it, really. I mean, sure, the quality of the content and how much and all that kind of stuff, they're manufacturing. But even like simple things like your little high eight will often key better than the green screen in the HDD room. Mm-hmm. And so you can buy these fabrics, they're 4x4, and you sit behind the pastor, have a single light, one of the things. And you could create, you just have this really nice background, so it looks nice. It's not hard to do, you know? And it really just raises, and it's realistic, you know, it's doable for a 75-minute, you know, congregation. It's one of the things in working with some of the bigger media industries that has been for a long time. We are trying to develop some things for ages where we are producing programs that the local church can say, hey, we're not interested in that one, but we like this one. And then when they advertise it on the local, on their website, people will go to your website, not go back to California. So then you have the direct connection. We did some experimentation, like not here with some situation. But now with the Arlington Church, we're trying to develop it. I'll talk about it a little bit because hopefully it'll give you some ideas. And also there's some things that we're building that we really intend to make available to anyone that wants to use it. Just, you know, it's kind of at least important to me that, you know, we're not trying to, tend to be around long enough that someone says, hey, we developed this great program, now do it like us. And it's not that, say, hey, this is what we're doing, if you can use some of this, let's see how we can benefit from it too. You know, it's just, so. Let's go in, we're going to go into the next room in a second, and what we're going to be showing you is it's a Mac-based software program. It's called ProPresenter, right? Ryan is a member of the Arlington Church there, and has been actively working on developing a website and does a lot of the media stuff for all the services that we have there. And we just recently switched to this particular program. Now, I mentioned it's a Mac program. There are some PC programs that we do similar things. We switched to this one because we went to a large passion, I think it was, and big venues, and it's kind of more and more people are adopting this particular one. And I've used three different ones.
So there are ones that will do that. The main purpose here is really not to show you how to do it, of course. It's just to expose you that this is what something can do. All right? And feel free. He'll kind of give you a quick demo and show some stuff.
Yeah, if you have questions about it.
And then, so mostly not so much the fact that it's a Mac program, just that, hey, this is what it's capable of doing. And we can talk about some of the trends. So it's kind of getting, it's kind of a standing room only kind of thing here, but let me tell you how I got into computers. I spent 2 years in college theology major. Mm-hmm. And I learned more about writing in those 2 years than any English guy. I mean, my religion professor, if you had one punctuation error, you'd go a letter grade.
Yeah.
So they had a computer at school, right? It was one of those that filled the entire building. And when you wanted to type something, you had to put a character, say paragraph, then type it. And then it would print out what they called this Diablo printer, and it was definitely Diablo, man. And it literally was a typewriter connected to a computer. Well, you'd have to go to another building, and you'd find that it wasn't correct. You'd go back, wait in line. I said, forget this. I went back to the whiteout. My brother, who was a physical therapist, got one of the first Macs before they were released, and he was doing a programming for a physical therapy thing. He brought it home, and he told me how to turn it on, and he told me a couple things not to do. And in 20 minutes, I was printing out my book report that I had for that class. And I said, this is the computer for me. And so ever since, that's what I've been doing. So I'm a Mac guy, so I just say that up front. Now let's talk about the differences in terms of, well, not differences, I'm not getting into that discussion. But the bottom line is pretty much most anything that we showed you can do in the PC world. The Mac, you know, what? Remember not too long ago, the Mac was like about ready to die. And what really kept Mac alive was desktop publishing. Well, Mac then switched into the video world. And there's a lot of things about Mac that dealing with video is so much easier with them. But in the end, I generally use Final Cut Pro. The competing product at that level is Adobe Premiere. A very good program that's getting better and better. One of the great things with Adobe Premiere is, especially a lot of young people, they'll get familiar with Photoshop and After Effects and all this kind of stuff. They work together really well, particularly on the PC. You know, there's a couple of programs that are only PC that Adobe does. So, so anything you saw, that it doesn't have to be Mac. These are just, we've gone that direction because it solves some problems. One, a lot of us are all Mac people. But there's some other, there are some things in the PC world when it deals with video that I don't know why they do it the way they do. And it's, once you work it out, it's okay, but it does take a little more work to do it. And so that's kind of the spiel on that. I've never really used, what comes with Windows, the editing, is it called Movie Maker? What's that?
Movie Maker?
Is that what it is?
A very personal view on that.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
But, I mean, a lot of the stuff like for your podcast, stuff like that, you don't need much money, something like that. Like, by the way, write this down. There's a website called lynda.com. It's lynda.com. I mentioned Photoshop, After Effects, all that kind of stuff. Lynda.com is a website that has tutorials, and it costs $25 a month. And you can sign on for 1 month, or you can sign up for the whole year. And there's some other fees if you want to just sign up for the whole thing. But the reason I mention that, if you have some, you know, say, okay, I want to try and do this Adobe Premiere thing, or I want to do Photoshop things, it's a complicated program. You got a lot of these young people, they're looking for something to do, they have a lot of good instincts, they just don't know how to do it. Lynda.com will take you straight to it. This is how you do it, step by step, to advance things. On Photoshop, it even has some basic Pro Tools, audio things, different things. It's a great website. And they're always adding new stuff.
we actually subscribe to it. It's just, and like I said, you know, there's so many things you can do with it now, do with those programs. A lot of the young people, their aesthetic instincts are just natural, and they just need to come out and operate a tool and who's been trained. It's very affordable, it's a very useful way. In fact, my kids, I'm going to send them through it because, you know, you could be in high school and your kids, and, you know, remember, I don't know about you, but when I was younger, I was making a living mowing lawns. Doing websites and video stuff using Photoshop, that's kind of the modern mowing lawn. Only my nephew, get this, this just makes me sick, you know. I'm thinking about mowing lawns and, you know, sweating and, you know, the push things, you know, this, none of this riding mower stuff, you know. This kid gets on his computer, it's a little older, smaller than this. He makes this little tiny flash game. A month ago, we got a $1,000 check for that stupid thing. And he also created this little website that he created these custom things for MySpace. And at the time, they're not really that aesthetically good, brave at all, but he's kind of hooked in with Google or something. With the ads and stuff, he was getting checks for like $45, $150. This guy was like 2 years ago, he's a senior now, so, you know. But he got a $1,000 check. That was, we got 500 first and he got a $1,000 check. I'm not even sure how that all works. It got something to do with the ads that attached to it, but he just made this silly game. I was there, it was during Christmas break, and he was working on it in the afternoon. He did a lot of work. I mean, it was pretty creative what he did. But he got a $1,000 check for it, you know. It's like, that was like 6 months worth of mowing lawns for me, man. Minimum wage, you know. It's like, actually, that would have been a year. That was back when I walked 5,000 miles to school in 10 feet of snow, you know. No. So anyway... Lynda.com, it's L-Y-N-D-A. All right, let's talk about some cameras here. This camera here, I can break it, I'll show it to you. This is a Panasonic camera, and the model number is HVX200. There's a couple of features I want to show you on here that, regardless of what model, that if you want to get, you know, a decent professional camera, it's one thing right here. See this? That's an XLR with 3-pin, your standard microphone. That's one thing you want to at least get up to that level. And you make sure you get good audio. If you have those, you're generally going to have some kind of control, you know, decent control. These are called XLR. It's basically standard, you know, audio cable. The alternative to that is little RCA things like you have on a DVD player or something like that. But if there's anything that's important, is that in terms of good quality audio. And see, a common thing that I like to do is that, like, with a camera like this, I would take the audio from the mixing board, whatever's mixing the sound from the sanctuary, you put it in one of these. And then the second one, like in this camera you said, the second channel, I use the camera mic. And then I make sure that I can see the level. So in the event that there's a problem or it doesn't work, if the camera's in the center of the room and stuff like that, it'll pick up pretty good. You'll definitely tell that you're in a room as opposed to, you know, the microphone, right? From the speaker or something, but at least you can still hear it. And if there's a choir or a band or, you know, or that kind of thing, generally it'll you know, it sounds pretty good because there's a lot of, you know, ambience.
Do most cameras with an XLR plug have two channels then? And most without don't?
I wouldn't say that. Probably they might have, I don't know if you have much control over it.
That's a good question. I haven't looked at this one.
Well, but then either way, you could, I have a camcorder that's, higher end, and it doesn't have an XLR, but I'm wondering if I could still plug it into an audio board and, still have a monitor.
Well, generally what those would have is they'll have like a, either they'll have the RCA outs, so you have them balancing, and, especially if you're using it for a podcast or something like that, that's going to be fine. But if you want the professional, sound XLR, another thing that's beneficial, well, even the consumer ones have this, but this has what's called some gain control. Just like an audio, they call it gain, video has the same thing, and it's boosting the video signal. Of course, the more gain you put on, it's grainy. The video looks worse. But the reason you would do that, of course, is if you're in a very dark situation and you need more light. That's the way you do it. It's just like if you have an audio signal and it's a little too quiet, you raise the volume, so you may hear more noise in the room, but at least you can hear it. So it's kind of the same thing. And in video, they refer to it as noise, just like they do in audio. This particular camera, I think, changed the price. It's around $4,499. The reason I say I think every time I look, it changes. I believe we got these for less than that. One of the great things about these is that it records on tape and disc. Now, quite frankly, this may be a price paid for it, but you may say, hey, listen, I can do this. These are very expensive. This guy here was a favorite. They keep coming down in price, but it's still expensive. Now, one of the values of that is you can spend, several hundred dollars on tape for the week, or you can use this for a computer. So it's a cost configuration that you've got to be concerned about. But this happens to be kind of the trend, going to some non-destructible or virtually non-destructible medium. This basically is the flash cards or whatever you have in the camera, or still camera. They've grouped a bunch of them together and they're kind of like super fast ones and they put it into this card. That's what these are. Sony's, their new camera, they have one now. One of the advantages with their new camera is they're using much cheaper memory that you can go down to Best Buy and that kind of stuff. This you have to buy from Samsung. Actually, I think Fuji or one of the companies have got that as well. And this will keep dropping. You'll probably be able to get it to for $200 or something like that. But still, that's a lot of money. But good quality DV tape, kind of want to stay away from the $2, $3 ones. Good quality is going to be, the fries is $8, $9. Why would you want to do that? If you really want to maintain your quality as best as possible and make copies and you want to store it, you go with the better quality, it lasts, it holds up better. Some of the poor quality tapes, they will clog up your heads. And then you do that, these cameras aren't worth fixing. When an engineer costs $80 an hour to fix even your small home video camera, it's like, well, I paid $400 and it's going to take you how many hours to fix it? It kind of gets into that, when something costing $4 or $5, it may be sort of big. It may never, when you start getting into the tape area and stuff like that, it gets really expensive and it never works well enough. It's really fine stuff. Now, this camera, you can record on tape. Now, one thing about Panasonic in their camera is it records actually mini DV. It does not do HD. This one over here does. But Sony has a pretty popular camera called Z1 View, that that shoots HDV. And by the way, as much as I said about HDV, a lot of your newspapers, you know, if you go online, they have a lot of video material, they're all using HDV. Even some of your news stations are using HDV cameras. So, I mentioned that in terms of, as much as I kind of poo-pooed HDV, it puts out a good picture, and if you're just shooting, it works great, it's fine. This particular camera only does DV, but on this, it can do all kinds of different formats, all the way up to HD. And so, this is a 16 gig drive. You can get, let's see, I'm trying to think now. At a very decent broadcast level, better than DV, you get probably at least a couple hours on there, I think. I need to double check that. They're also coming out with bigger ones. This one's 16 gig, they have a 32 gig out already, and 64 is supposed to be delivered. And you start getting it up in that range. And this, so you can put on, you can put two in here, there's one here and one here. And so if you put two of them in there, you can shoot for a long time and be just fine. Now, also, this one here has the FireWire cable. Another thing to kind of watch for is HDMI coming in. You heard of HDMI? If you start looking at the new TV sets like in Circuit City, Best Buy, HDMI is really starting to take off. If you know, you're familiar with FireWire, FireWire basically one cable sends picture, sends your audio, and you can even control this camera. You can, you know, control the tape. You can rewind the tape, forward the tape. Now all that communication and image and audio comes through FireWire. HDMI is kind of the same thing, only it's kind of a new format. I think it originally was just so, one of the great things, if you buy a DVD player, if you buy a TV, you don't have to have all these different cables, just one cable. Well, it's starting to appear on your cameras. And I think more and more that's going to be a pretty good feature to be looking for. It might even replace FireWire, I don't know. But how that would apply is when you need to get whatever you have in whatever camera you have into your computer, that's how you do it. And it's just one cable. You don't have to have all these complicated setups and stuff like that. It's just so simple. So kind of you want to keep an eye out for that. This camera here kind of represents the high end of the low end, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Obviously the price. But this does almost everything that their $60,000 version does. The major difference is the lens. It doesn't have an interchangeable lens. So they have a $60,000 one that's a little bigger than this, and it competes with the Sony camera that did the Star Wars and stuff like that. The Sony camera is $180,000. The Panasonic system. Well, this does everything. I mention all that because the other doesn't really matter much. It's just that is what the trend is that now you can get a camera this size that, you know, this has been out for 2-3 years, I think, now. Before that, you couldn't touch anything that does what this does for less than $60,000. And there's more stuff coming out that pretty soon these will be less. That's why I say I'm not sure. It could have dropped again. These can become less because they're coming out with new stuff that they're having to compete with Sony and that kind of thing. So, but these are really good, solid cameras. The downside of these is that when you want to use them in a multi-camera situation, I know what we talked about, you know, your three cameras, there's no way, no good way to connect these together. because there isn't the spigots on here to take the digital signal out. You know, there's FireWire, and you can do that, but it's kind of a technical nightmare. You know, sometimes it works if you go too far, it doesn't. The little spigot that you see on here, it won't take long, and that'll wear out. You know, and so you can do it, and people are doing it. And I'll show you the switcher in a second here, where they make models you can do that. But it's pretty dicey. And that's one of the down things. So with these, now this does have a feature to where you can sync these up. And I said I was going to go into it, I'll mention it now. There's a feature called timecode. And I won't go into a lot of detail. Bottom line is that they have a method where they video for long, film. If you remember when you're using film, you'll notice on the edge there's like barcodes and there's numbers. Well, in film, they use feet and frames. So if they need to find a specific frame, they say it's at such and such a foot, it's such and such a frame. Well, video needed some way to find that frame. So when you're making an edit, you say, okay, I want to use the shot where the car is. You know, I've shot an hour, and I've got a car, I've got a boat, I've got a plane. I want the shot of the car. They create a time code. And time code is just a way of identifying specific frame. Where it gets a little confusing is that there's a feature with time code. Time code can tell you time. In other words, my piece is 10 minutes long. My piece is 20 minutes long. Whereas, you know, with film, feet and frames, you know it's only feet, you still have to calculate how many minutes that was. Whereas time code, they can tell you how many minutes your footage is. I've shot 40 minutes. Now, one of the problems, and I don't want to drill down too much about this, but when you get into editing, you'll at least encounter it. When video first came out in the States, it was black and white, and it was 30 frames per second. So the time code is based on 30 frames per second. It counts. So every 30 frames, it goes up a second. And time code, if you haven't seen it, looks like this. So what that says is this is 1 hour, 3 minutes, 0 seconds, in 15 frames. So as this, so we would know that, hey, this is 1 hour and 3 minutes long, or a typical practice they would start, if it's your first tape, you'd set it 1 hour, second tape, set 2 hours. So this is a 3 minute, you shot 3 minutes on the thing. Well, that time code was based on 30 frames per second. There, when they went to color, there was a technical reason that they found out that when they added color to the signal, the audio interfered with the color. But they found when they slowed it down, and they slowed it down to 2997, it took care of the problem. So even though we're shooting 30 frames per second, we're really not. It's 2997 for the standard. And there is some math that makes sense why they chose that particular thing, and blah, 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 whatever. I bring it up because there's a couple of places you can see that. When you go into your cameras, even your smaller ones now, because they're all trying to do 24 frame lines and stuff, they're going to ask you, do you want to shoot 30 frames per second, do you want 29.97, all this kind of stuff. It gets kind of confusing. The bottom line is that just be aware that our standard video is not actually running at 30 frames per second. And most of the time when people talk about it, they'll just say 30 frames per second. They'll agree with it. And that's the same thing. Remember I was talking about the interlacing, and there's a field one and a field two? Add even to more confusion. In fact, Panasonic, I think, does this. A couple of other studios as well. they'll have an option, you can choose 60. It doesn't say if it's 60 frames. No, it's Sony that does this. You have an option to choose 60. So is that 60 frames? It ends up at 60 field. So you choose 60, and you're choosing 30 frames per second. Because they're telling you it's 60 fields, because of course, two fields to make one frame. And you can see how confusing that is. And so I just want to, it's confusing to me, and I've worked with it a long time. Just know that it's not running 30 frames per second. One of the popular things right now, particularly in HD, is to give you the option to do 24 frames per second. 24 frames per second matches film. When you go to a movie or any of that kind of thing, it's playing at 24 frames per second. And then I guess they have to figure that's the optimal speed for how our eyes work and all that kind of stuff. And it's one of the things that makes a big difference. You can tell if something was shot on video and shot on film, and most people prefer things that were shot on film. So even on your smaller cameras, you're going to start seeing that thing. Just know, our standard video, they generally abbreviate it to 30 frames per second. In your editing systems, they may ask you, do you want it at 29.97 or 30 or stuff like that. Just know that those issues exist. And probably for most of your things for your podcast, you're not going to have to worry about it. Where you might worry about it is someone that maybe has a little more experience and they want to be extra creative, and they'll go shoot something at 24 frame, and you're trying to work with it, and you don't know it's 24 frame, because you don't do that. That's where it kind of becomes a problem. Right? So just know that that issue exists. And
so if you have 24 frames per second and you have 29.97, can you mix them together? Is that a problem?
Well, if you're going to do 24 frames per second, you'll actually do 23.94, I think. The audio would be different.
Mm-hmm.
It does adjust. Because that's where you often find it, is that when you choose a particular video rate, they'll ask you what you want for that. That's exactly what we're talking about.
That's
And in mixing and stuff like that, you're seeing more and more because you're trying to match it with video, and it's a wet speech with the ad, and blah, blah, blah. So it's kind of confusing. But like I said, this kind of represents the high end and the low end. The one thing it doesn't do is, you have to record it and bring them all together and the editing system. Well, the one thing this will do, it does have a technique where you can sync the cameras up with that type of thing. Each camera can have the same time code, there's a way to sync it up. So they all have the same one. So when you put it in the editing system, you can line it up. Okay, I want that 1 hour, 3 minute, that's where I want to start all my cameras. And then they're all synced up. And in the editing system, it's pretty cool. Then you can literally just kind of switch through, and it's pretty fast. And you can kind of make it work. I'm going to point up a couple things out of this one. We're going to go in here before we wrap it up tonight. This is the camera itself, I think, is about 7,000. This whole configuration comes in around the front. This isn't all of it, there's more of it inside. That includes the tripods. By the way, these are fluid head tripods. So basically, they're literally as a fluid. You'll notice if you have a cheaper still camera and you're trying to get your nose. Basically, what it's designed to do is to resist you a little bit, so it's easier to make smooth moves up and down. They're not cheap, but they make all the difference in the world. Like we're doing the graduation, we're all the way out in the room. In other words, we're at the back of the auditorium and we're zoomed over the room. And so any slight movement, panning and all that kind of stuff, up and down, just helps make it a little more smooth. You're that far out, and you have the big screens in there. If you're shaking a little bit here on the screens, it's going to go like this. What this works, see this big cable here? Basically, each of your cameras have this cable, and we'll go into this room in a second here. We can control all the exposure, the gain, everything, but focus, basically, and zoom in there. That's how we can make sure all the cameras match.
is also through that cable we have, the intercom system, where the director can tell them what to do. This viewfinder is the nicest viewfinder. I've worked on the news and things, and they have viewfinders this big. It's pretty cool. This thing right here is called a tally light, so when you pick that camera, this light comes on, so you can know that camera is on. This camera can come out of this. They call this a sled, and what this whole sled is for, it takes all the information, all the connections from the camera, get put into this, and then converted to this. That's what this whole big thing is. And we can also put a teleprompter, if you've seen those things, where they put in front of the camera, and so could be reading the text and the angle news and stuff like that. This has the remote zoom. That's one of the problems with some of the smaller cameras. You get these little zoom controls on, it's really hard to make this. This camera's pretty good because the lens is heavier. It's an underscore. But all the intercom, I was mentioning, like in this particular camera, in here, these are all the connections on this camera. And this has a firewire, but it's got the bigger firewire. It has your standard RCA things, which you see on a smaller camera, so it can do that as well. In here, one of these options, it says Genlock, there's standard definition, there's HD. These particular cameras can shoot HDV on tape. You can shoot standard definition SDI, and I'll explain in a bit what that is. But it has, and the Genlock is in here, there's time code things, there's all these different connections that goes in and goes on to this sled. One of the things, if you have the budget for it, you can start with just the camera. I mean, it's obviously still expensive, but if you really feel like you're going to go to a professional way, you can start with that, and then you can add parts to it. And I can only afford one, and that may be what I have for the next 3 years or so. But what the camera's capable of, it's pretty robust. I suppose you may not want to have a camera for more than 5 years with technology, but nevertheless, it will do what it can do now. No matter if they come out with something new, it still does. But I remember I started with photography, and I remember the Canon AE-1, that was like a big deal. And then people kept adding all these features, and pretty soon the features didn't help you take a better picture. They're just added cost to the camera. Some of the early electronic features and kind of mappings, they were useful. But then it just started becoming trinkets, or just adding cost and not for a lot of gain. Let's head into the other room. And Casey, if you want to bring the lights up in here.